Hello, and welcome to the Bad Pharma edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Axios, and I'm joined, as ever this week, by Anna Szymanski.
Hello.
And by Emily Peck.
Hello, hello.
Of the Huffington Post. And the big news this week, there's been a lot of news in business and finance news this week. The big news this week is that I think, possibly for the first time ever, Emily and Anna are actually on the same page for most of this podcast. We are going to be talking about Apple's move into services. We are going to be talking about Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family. We are going to be talking about the Lyft IPO. And somehow, it seems that, like, the world's great contrarian, Ms. Anna Szymanski, like, even she can't bring herself to defend the Sacklers.
Oh, good God, no.
Or even to try and work out, like, why people are buying into this Lyft IPO at $90 a share or whatever it's trading at. So all of that coming up on Slate Money.
On Debt, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
So let's talk about Apple, which has been releasing all manner of amazing things over the past few weeks. They released a new set of AirPods, which charge wirelessly and have longer battery life. They released a new iMac, which is super swanky and fast. And they released a whole suite of new iPads. And they had a huge event in Cupertino in their amazing new Steve Jobs Theater, which announced absolutely none of those because they are no longer a gadgets company.
They're services company.
They are
shifting to services.
Services. They care much more about services. Services are a tiny part of their revenue by Apple standards, by any other normal company standards. Their services revenue is enormous, but by Apple standards, their services revenue is small. But this is clearly what they care about, and oh boy, do they care about it. They who did they bring out? They brought out Steven Spielberg and Oprah and
Jennifer Aniston, Reese Witherspoon,
all manner of amazing people and celebrities. And what were these celebrities announcing? Do we have any real clarity on that?
It was, from what I saw, a bunch of half-baked stuff. It was Apple TV Plus coming soon with a show starring Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston, which unclear what it kind of is. And there was a video game subscription service, which I don't kind of know how that works. There was this magazine subscription service, which I guess got a lot of attention from my journalist Twitter feed, but is basically just an update of what it kind of already has.
So they had this thing called Apple News, and now there's this new thing called Apple News Plus, which
it's a revamp of Texture. Yeah.
Which used to be Texture, which used to advertise on Slate Money. Thank you, Texture. And you can use it to read a whole bunch of things which you couldn't read previously on Apple News because they were behind the paywall. But now if you pay Apple News,
$10 a month,
you can read them. It's unclear how much uptake this is going to receive. It's also unclear how easy it is to read stories in the way that people naturally read stories in the age of social media, which is by clicking on links
But Facebook, I think, or Twitter. What's important here is that Apple is clearly trying to position itself as the one-stop shop for media content. So whether you're talking about news or whether you're talking about streaming video, yes, partly they're going to be producing some of their own content, but the idea is also that you're going to come to Apple first and then you're going to go to all of these other different services.
And that somehow they are going to take a whopping great cut
exactly.
of all of that money that you spend on whether it's news or video or gaming or just about anything else. They want, or even like spending money on a credit card, they want to take a slice.
Yeah, and we should talk, I think, about the credit card and Apple Pay. But I will say, I mean, the services announcement, I think, was met by a lot of skepticism, you know, when it came out. One thing I'll say is Apple News is actually a good product. I don't know if our listeners use it or not, but I mean, when I sit on my Metro North train in the morning or in the afternoon, everyone uses it. I mean, and just looking at traffic stats at HuffPost, see a lot of traffic from Apple News. It's a successful product in my estimation. So, I mean, the idea that they could be a one-stop shop for other kinds of media, like Anna was saying, actually doesn't quite, I mean, it doesn't seem like an impossible.
Well, especially because there are 1.4 billion Apple products that people are using. And, mm-hmm. and that's the issue here. If you're looking at a lot of these services, you say, well, does Apple really have some type of competitive advantage? Well, that is their advantage. Mm-hmm. They already have this built-in addressable market.
And one of the things we learned with Apple Maps was that that is a huge advantage for them. Like when Apple Maps launched, it was like, I don't know if you can say this, but head and shoulders below Google Maps. Like it was so much worse than Google Maps. It's improved since then. But for years, literally for years, it was like no one in their right mind given the choice, and everyone was technically given the choice, would prefer Apple Maps to Google Maps. And yet some huge percentage of iPhone users, I think it was like 85 or 90% of iPhone users, used Apple Maps. This is the power of defaults. Mm-hmm.
But I think, I don't know why I'm hawking Apple News so hard, but it's genuinely a better product than like the other ways. Like you were saying, is it how people consume information now? And like if you could go to Twitter to get your news, you could go to Facebook to get your news, but all that stuff is so tainted. Apple News is a little bit curated by humans
It is curated by
not
humans.
Not fully. I think the loading pages.
It's a collection of publications which are, you know, professional news publications, and each one of those professional news publications, even if it doesn't have Apple people working for them, has like professional journalists working for mm-hmm. them. And more or less, to a, you know, first degree of approximation, if you read something on Apple News, you can trust it.
Yeah, I think this is civilized.
And I think this is interesting because Apple, you know, historically has been focusing on offering premier products. That's been the whole idea. You pay more for getting mm-hmm. this better product. And it seems in services, they're kind of trying to do the same thing. I think this is interesting in gaming because they're trying to position it as like this is where the best game designers want to put out their product because it's not the kind of cheap free stuff that you can already get. Mm-hmm. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens moving forward with that, because overall, to me, it seems like Apple is trying to kind of move in a little bit to the Tencent market. Right? They're kind of trying to follow that model of how they've been able to generate a tremendous amount of money without actually having to do too much of selling your data to advertisers. And it seems to me that that's where Apple is maybe trying to say, oh, look, you know, how can we make money off of gaming? Granted, Tencent's model is very, very different. Also, potentially the idea of getting into mobile payments, getting more into mobile payments.
That was one of the interesting things about this event was that, you know, while they didn't talk about the AirPods, and the AirPods are by far the most popular new product that Apple has come out with in years, way more popular than Apple News or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And they didn't even mention them, whereas they had a huge amount of, you know, dazzling their time and whatnot devoted to Apple Card, which is basically at heart just another MasterCard that you can add to Apple Pay along with all of the other MasterCards and Visas and American Expresses that you can already add to Apple Pay. And it behaves pretty much the same way that they all do, except for it has an Apple logo on it and your card is titanium.
And it doesn't have the full number exposed on the card.
Well, there is no, on the actual card. Yeah. But I think
the actual card is kind of interesting if you want to nerd out a little bit. It has a number which is embedded in the magnetic strip on the back of the card, but no human being can ever see that number, so no one can ever steal that number.
I think that's kind of wild.
It is kind of awesome.
Yeah, and I think, though, that really what they're trying to do, to me it seems like, is it's less about the card itself, is it's trying to just shift more and more people into Apple mm-hmm. Pay, because eventually they want that kind of WeChat Pay or Alipay idea where, you know, you have your money goes to a bank account. Then you take that money and you just put that money into this like Apple wallet eventually, and then all of those different fees that currently credit cards and banks get, Apple wants to be able to get those types of fees.
I mean, the Apple Card, they've said, has no fees, and this is true. And it's for a no-fee credit card, it's a good credit card. It gives you decent cash back. It has no annual fee. It has no late fees, like the interest rate that you pay on your balance does not go up if you're overdue on your payment, that kind of thing. They've said that the interest rate in general is going to be low compared to other cards, and I believe them on that. So I think as a product, it's a good product. But what's interesting about it to me is that it is the first card which is designed to be a virtual card first. It's a digital card first. And then only in like extreme situations when some Luddite refuses to accept Apple Pay are you forced to take out your beautiful titanium card without any numbers on it.
I mean, this is what Apple does, actually. It's not a pivot. Apple changes consumer behavior in order to keep consumers tethered to its product. So it's doing that in this case with a card.
Right, because the U.S. is so far behind countries like China when it comes to digital payments. So there's so
much
growth.
It's so far
behind
countries like India when it comes to digital payments. I mean, there's almost no country in the world which is, you know, further behind.
And partly that has to do with the way that our banking system works and the regulations work. It's actually very hard for fintech companies to operate in the United States. We have a very balkanized
system. Because we
don't
have a central bank. We have 12 central banks. And in any other country, whether it's Sweden or India or anywhere else, the central bank just comes along and says, okay, people, you need instant payments digitally between all bank accounts, and then the banks have to do it. Mm-hmm. But there doesn't seem to be any regulator both willing and able to do that in America.
So it's up to Apple.
So Apple becomes yet another service, a little bit like PayPal, which is also Venmo, or Square Cash, and there's a bunch of other ones, Stripe, which kind of store money for you, and they get to like earn interest on that money. Like if you have a Apple Pay balance, if you have cash in Apple Pay, that is cash that is sitting on Apple's balance sheet basically earning interest, and they don't pay interest. So
that's where the money is for them, and all this other stuff, news, video games, Reese Witherspoon, that's all just to get you in their orbit. And it's really the trick is to get you using your phone to pay for stuff.
I'm not sure. I don't think Apple Pay is, I don't think payments is going to be that big of a revenue item for Apple, just because the percentages are so much lower that, you know, you can earn a little bit of interest on the, you know, $25 balance I have on my Apple Pay account. But compared to the 50% of the $10 a month that I'm paying for Apple News, you know, that's $60 a year. It's going to be pretty hard for Apple to get $60 a year in interest on, you know, I would need to have a huge amount of money Apple Pay.
No one's going to pay for Apple.
Yeah, and I think the idea is that they know that immediately they're not going to be able to make a tremendous amount of money off of this, but if eventually they could shift more and more people towards digital payments and away from the kind of having to go through all of these intermediaries in banks, then a lot of those fees that merchants pay and such, the idea is eventually those could go directly to Apple.
Because your iPhone will be your credit card.
Well, it doesn't go directly to Apple.
It doesn't.
Remember that Apple Pay itself, all of the Apple Pay terminals everywhere in the world, all of that money moves along the Visa and MasterCard rails.
100%.
Like, Apple is not replacing Visa and MasterCard. It is basically working with Visa and MasterCard. And all of that interchange that Visa and MasterCard currently charge will continue to be charged and will continue to go to Visa and MasterCard.
Exactly. You know,
to issuing banks.
That's not, I think, where they see things moving eventually. I think eventually they want to be able to cut out those intermediaries. They can't do it now. But I think they want to get people used to paying in this way and then eventually be able to shift more towards the kind of models we've been seeing in China.
I think that sounds interesting.
I mean, that sounds interesting.
That's what I think. I could be 100% wrong.
But, you know, as a payments nerd, I can tell you that, like, just in terms of infrastructure, I can't see how that's possible. I think in an amazing future world, Apple would love it if all of those Apple Pay terminals suddenly, like, disconnected from the Visa and MasterCard rails and started connecting to some, like, Apple fintech rails, but I would be astonished if they were working on that, because that basically turns Apple into a highly regulated piece of financial infrastructure, and I'm not sure that's what they want to be. That's why they're working with Goldman Sachs for this card. All of the actual financial plumbing with this card is being done by Goldman. It's not being done by Apple.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Emily.
Hi.
Tell me about the Sackler family. Are they like sweating these days?
They are sweating these days. Blood is in the water for the Sackler family.
Do they need some like, you know, medication to help deal with that pain?
They probably need some long-acting OxyContin to help them relieve the pain of being seen as exposed as evil. I'm just going to say that flat out.
You can say that flat out.
So the news is that there's a lawsuit in Oklahoma. They sued the Sackler family, I believe, and Purdue Pharma for basically causing an opioid crisis in the state. And they settled for $270 million. And there are a lot of other lawsuits pending around the country. New York filed one this week against Sackler's personally and Purdue Pharma in particular as
so
well.
So that's the difference between the New York case and the Oklahoma case. Is the Oklahoma case was just against Purdue
Thank
Pharma,
you. Yeah.
which was founded by the Sacklers and yeah. is largely owned by the Sacklers, but is still like this limited liability corporate entity.
Right.
Whereas the New York case is going against the Sackler family individually and saying, oh, and yeah, we see you setting up all of these shell corporations and paying yourself billions of dollars
right.
like, under the table.
And now Purdue Pharma, I think one of the reasons they were able to settle in Oklahoma is they're now threatening to declare bankruptcy to avoid liability for what they've done. And what they've done is cause at least 200,000 deaths in this country, thanks to OxyContin specifically, I believe.
Well, I mean, it's so if you look at overall deaths, the line that Purdue Pharma will say, which is, I will tell you, you can pretty much say it's not accurate. But what they will say is that, well, we only actually have like 6% market share. And a lot of the opioid deaths as well are actually not necessarily caused by OxyContin, but caused by fentanyl or heroin. But
why even repeat that?
Well, but
they started this.
No. But my point is that, like, I'm just saying like, this is what the other argument is. But of course, the reason that that doesn't hold water is because they were the ones who really first started pushing this. And their whole goal initially, it was kind of interesting. It wasn't just necessarily to sell their medication. They would really push their reps to just get doctors more comfortable prescribing opioids in general, with the idea that they were going to just increase the overall market. And then they were going to be able to really, really, really start pushing their specific drug.
They talked about combating opioid phobia, which was the reticence by doctors to prescribe highly addictive medicines.
They lied and
marketed this drug as not being addictive because it's, you know, it was long acting.
It was even bigger than that. What they did was they started talking about how every doctor should consider pain to be a vital sign. And that when you're like trying to work out the health of your patient, you should always ask, like, are you in pain? How much pain are you in? Are you in chronic pain? And the pain relief, which was this, you know, multi-billion-dollar opportunity for them, was something which they just wanted to bring into every single doctor's visit that anyone ever had. And that, you know, if they could get some small percentage of a massively increased pain relief pie, then, you know, they were selling a highly addictive substance. And then once people got onto that, they would continue to, you know, use OxyContin or other Purdue Pharma things, or, you know, they didn't particularly care about this, or they would just wind up taking heroin.
Yeah. And one thing that's become clear with all these lawsuits, especially the one in Massachusetts, the AG Maura Healey filed, I think, in January, is how much the Sacklers themselves knew about how addicted people were becoming to these drugs and how soon. So it was like 1996, I think, the drug was released on the market. And it was pretty soon after that reports were coming in that people were crushing and snorting and injecting these drugs and people were dying and becoming quite addicted. And I believe it was Richard Sackler, I think, was CEO at the time, you know, was like, well, that's their problem. There was, you know, this the classic ethos of individual responsibility really taken to its extreme here, where you release this extremely addictive drug, lie about what it does, and then blame people for becoming addicted to it.
And this is interesting in terms of how there are a lot of internal emails have come out showing how involved a lot of the Sackler family was in the actual marketing.
Yes.
And in the marketing plans and the idea of how you should talk about the addiction concerns, how you should talk about things like pseudo addiction, which is in fact just addiction.
Yes.
And they, you know, it was very, very hands on, which is obviously extremely important moving forward in terms of not just the company being held liable, but these individuals being held liable.
Right. And then I think we should probably also talk about, which I think we touched on last week with Anna's number, which is how the Sacklers themselves tried to keep their name out of this nasty business. And
reputation laundering by building Sackler wings in all of the grandest museums in the world. And there's a really fascinating subtext to this story. which is there are basically two arms of the Sackler family, one of which is associated with Purdue Pharmaceuticals and one of which isn't. And the non-Purdue Sacklers were also creating Sackler wings. And there's this really interesting kind of thing, like saying, should we just get rid of Sackler wings? And then there's a whole bunch of people saying, well, we can't really blame the non-Purdue Sacklers, but it's all like part of this broader reputation laundering for the family as a whole.
And apparently it was going on pre-OxyContin, because I was reading, there's that great New Yorker piece from a couple of years ago on the
Patrick Radden Keefe. He was like, he was so early on this.
It was so good. And he talks about Arthur Sackler, who was one of the three brothers. You know, they were all doctors and they founded this company together. But he was like the marketing mastermind genius guy. And before OxyContin even, he was out there pushing Valium on Americans to the point where there was like a congressional hearing because there was a crisis over the overprescribing of Valium. They got doctors to just prescribe it for whatevs. Like, even if there wasn't anything wrong with patients, they were just getting Valium all the time. It was like, he was on this. This guy died in 1987, and he told his kids, allegedly, according to this New Yorker piece, leave the world a better place than when you entered it.
I have, I mean, one of the things that the Sacklers did and Purdue did, and it is by no means unique to them, but they were really ahead of the curve on this, was move from this idea that drug companies invent drugs which are used to treat disease, and then doctors will use those drugs if their patients have that disease, to this idea of drugs as a branded good which can be marketed.
Yes.
And they would spend billions of dollars marketing drugs to the medical profession. And those marketing dollars were very well spent. And doctors, it turns out, are very susceptible to these marketing campaigns.
Well, because I think, yes, there are obviously like bad doctors. But I also think a lot of it is you have doctors who legitimately want to help their patients. And when they're being told, you know, this is a safe drug, and they have so much, because chronic pain is a serious issue in the United States. And so they have people coming to them. It's not overly surprising that a lot of doctors, before they knew all these risks, would prescribe.
Yeah. One thing that killed me in the Patrick Radden Keefe piece was that Purdue Pharma specifically went after low-income areas to market the drugs. And that just, and now these areas are like just ravaged by the opioid crisis. You know, I guess they fixed OxyContin, so when you smush it now, you can't easily snort it anymore. But people still take it. And then the rest of the people that don't want that, they're taking other drugs, heroin, fentanyl, right, et cetera. It's just so sad. I think they should declare bankruptcy, and they should be, their names removed from everything, and they should just slink away. Like, I don't understand why these people aren't in jail. And I guess that sounds extreme, but like, people go to jail for a lot less in this country.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I always find interesting, though, and I agree with you.
Oh, my God.
I know. It's
wow.
Right? But no, I just say this because if you look at overall deaths of opioids, I mean, it's horrible. But they pale in comparison to the number of deaths caused by alcohol use. And I find it interesting just how we view substances. Now, I mean, and even cigarettes, it's and they're still legal. And I mean, alcohol, it's like 90,000 deaths a year. And that's not even taking into account all of the lost years. And I'm not saying, I'm not like Carrie Nation over here and saying, oh, we should outlaw alcohol. But I do think it raises these interesting questions about substances that do cause a tremendous amount of suffering, lost economic opportunity, mm-hmm, all of these things.
It just seemed like OxyContin was a very extreme product, you know, that had dubious value to begin with. It was like more extreme even, I don't know if I want to say cigarettes, but more extreme than alcohol.
No, I mean, it's certainly,
you can use alcohol in moderation.
There are a lot of people who drink regularly and, you know, suffer no health adverse consequences, no visible health adverse consequences as a result. There are even people who are, you know, genuinely addicted to alcohol who don't have a lot of adverse health consequences as a result. Like, it's the thing about the opioids is that it's very easy to get hooked. And then once you're hooked, you're almost certainly going to wind up getting like devastatingly addicted. The probabilities are so much higher.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep. While you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
So the big news of the week in finance was the Lyft IPO, the company which didn't quite manage to lose $1 billion last year, but came close, managed to raise over $2 billion in its IPO and went public at a very high valuation at $72 a share, which was, what, $25 billion-ish, something like that. And then immediately started trading at a 20% premium to that. So people really, some subset of investors out there in the universe really want to buy this stock. So I'm going to turn to Anna now and say, Anna, who are these people and why are they buying this stock?
This was like Lyft had to go out first because if Uber went out first, no one would want Lyft, basically. So it's almost like the Lyft IPO is a proxy for the Uber.
Well, I mean, this IPO is also a very large IPO. And this is, you know, it's one of the like kind of hotter companies that is coming to market. And I mean, it makes perfect sense.
Did you hear the A plus acronym, which I really, really hate? But apparently it stands for Airbnb, Pinterest, Lyft, Uber, and Slack.
A plus.
But I mean, I do think it makes sense that Lyft would want to come before Uber because it seems like if it came after, it would be kind of like, well.
Yeah, no one's buying Pepsi if Coke's out there.
Right. But I do think that's also, though, does raise the question of this valuation for a company where their growth is actually like the rate of growth is declining, and whereas the rate of growth of their costs are increasing at a point where we're clearly like hitting a, you know, kind of peak of the market.
Well, there's something interesting in the economics of these two companies because they're in this incredible price war and they're basically competing with each other for which one can subsidize every single ride more than the other, which like it's become largely a commodity business and people take whichever one is cheaper. And the one thing that both Lyft and Uber have learned is that if you come out with promotions and discounts and stuff like that, then people will react rationally to those and will wind up, you know, if they have a Lyft coupon, they'll take the Lyft. If they have an Uber coupon, they'll take the Uber. And so the two companies are fighting for basically spending billions of dollars to gain market share at the expense of the other. This cannot go on forever.
Well, because you could say, well, maybe that would make sense if they had some type of plan of like, this is how we will become profitable, the kind of like Amazon idea of like how you, well, I can lose all this money, but then eventually I develop AWS and everything's great.
I mean, the idea to become profitable is quite simple, which is that if and when you actually start paying the drivers less than you receive in fares, then you can pocket the difference.
Right, but then you're going to have to start charging quite a bit more, especially especially part of the reason that people take a lot of these services is partly because they're more convenient, but partly also because the price is usually decent. And now also, like in New York, we're having an increasing number of surcharges that are coming on top of this. So you are going to have a harder time growing your customer base if people are like, well, this is really, really expensive. Just basic economics, they're not going to use it as much.
But I think it's like that Apple thing too, where like Uber really has changed consumer behavior. Like the people I know that are like maybe a decade younger than me, like they don't even know how to call a car service in New York or like hail a cab anymore. It seems like everyone just does Uber. You don't even sometimes look at how much you paid until sometime after. So I could see a scenario where, you know, they do their little Uber Lyft death match. One succeeds, the other one goes away, and then starts charging more money.
Okay, but it would have to be a lot more money.
Okay, but here's the question, right? And which is the first question I asked Anna, and I really want to come back to, which is like, who is buying this stock and why are they buying it? Because it's very, very easy for anyone to point at a company which is like minus 44% EBITDA margins and say like, it doesn't make any sense. I don't understand why anyone would buy this for $1 a share, let alone, you know, $80 a share or $90 a share. So, but the more interesting question is to say like, look at the people who are buying it and ask yourself, why are they buying it? And to your point of like, you know, if they're hoping that there will be one winner and then that one winner can start collecting monopoly rents, isn't it obvious that the one winner is going to be Uber and not Lyft?
Yeah. So what is the answer to your question?
Well, I mean, to me, it seems like partly it's that, you know, ride hailing is this new part of kind of automotive industry that people haven't been able to take part in yet. Most people have not been able to kind of take part in the growth of this new industry. And I think that partly Lyft is benefiting from a little bit of the Uber sheen of this idea that this is the future of cars. This is the future. And not even just cars, but also bike scooters, how people move in the world. This is the future of that. And of course, I think this does tie into these like long-term ideas people have about driverless cars and how this is going to be part of that. I'm very suspect about all of that. But
Lyft is, you know, they're big in micro-mobility, as it's called. They're not just cars. They own City Bike in New York. They have a whole bunch of like scooter attempts to try and their idea is they're the company that will get you around cities, you know, when you're not using actual state-owned public transportation.
Well, and I also the bet on like everyone getting smart and trying to do something about climate change, and then a company like a Lyft is where you go because people aren't doing traditional driving anymore.
Partly it has to do with younger consumers' behavior, and I do think Lyft is positioning itself more as, you know, just mobility, right? Mm-hmm. And also more focused on just the U.S. They have, I think, Canada as well, but yeah. whereas Uber has lost a lot of money going overseas. And also Uber is trying out all of these different services as well, which to me, I actually think probably makes sense long term of diversifying.
Uber claims that, you know, Uber Eats alone is worth, you know, almost as much as Lyft. And they just bought Careem. They can every so often they buy rival companies, and every so often they sell rival companies or sell to rival companies in foreign countries. But they are much more of a sort of international ride-hailing platform. You can open your Uber app just about anywhere you go on the planet in any decent-sized city, and there's a very good chance that it will work. That isn't true of Lyft.
And it could be that if you're looking for a company that is really, really focused on mobility in basically the United States or just basically North America, that maybe it would make sense to go with a Lyft as opposed to going with Uber, which it does have clearly a very different focus.
The one thing I'll add, just because I have this little bee in my bonnet about it, is that Lyft is the first company to go, well, not the first, actually the second. The first one was Levi's, which also went public this week. Levi's and Lyft both went public this week after the S&P Dow Jones indices announced that any new company going public with a dual class share structure would not be allowed into the S&P 500. And both Levi's and Lyft went public with a dual class share structure, which means that neither of them, no matter how big they get, no matter how profitable they get, no matter how dominant they get, neither of them will ever be allowed into the S&P 500, and neither of them will ever have that you know, shareholder base of long-term index fund shareholders, which big companies love. It's fascinating they made that choice to me.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm very glad that the indices did this. I mean, I think we've talked about this before, but this is should be a concern for investors, this like just problems with corporate governance. I mean, I think you just have to look at a company like Facebook to see like what happens when you have people running the company who really aren't beholden to anyone.
So, yeah, Anna, Emily, and Felix have... utterly befuddled. We don't entirely understand why Lyft is seemingly so popular or who's buying it. So if you bought Lyft shares and intend to hold them for longer than about 5 minutes, do email us on slatemoney@slate.com, and we will try and maybe next week come back with the sort of bull case for Lyft. But I'm fascinated. I think honestly a lot of it is just momentum trading and creative fool theory and saying, well, this is a hot company which is going up, so I finally get to buy into it. But maybe there's more. Let us know.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Let's have a numbers round. I'm going to start, actually, this week with $6,790, which is the amount that the FCC has collected in fines from robocallers. It has sent out, get this, $208 million in fines on robocallers. There's a whole bunch of people who are breaking robocallers who are breaking the law, and they have been fined $208 million. Of that $208 million, the FCC has actually managed to collect $6,790.
That's pathetic. What is that?
They're not even paying for themselves now.
Oh my God. Why can't they catch them?
They disappear. They evaporate.
Oh, what a world. My number is $34,000. That is the cost of one dose of this new drug meant to help women with postpartum depression called Zulresso. So it's $34,000. And in order to take it, you need to stay in the hospital. So I think you wind up paying even more.
And how many doses do you need? Just one?
The one dose, and then you have to stay and be observed because I think it makes you a little dizzy. And there was a nice opinion piece in the Times about how this is such a problematic thing because obviously, only certain women will be able to afford this or have good enough insurance to afford it. Second of all, you have to be able to go back to the hospital and stay there while you have a new baby at home. And third of all, like a lot of the causes of postpartum depression occurs more frequently in societies with like higher income inequality, you know, things like that. And this doesn't seem like the right solution, you know, it's just like the pharmaceutical industry doing its thing. That's what I see.
I feel like we're like down on the pharma industry this week, but I feel they totally deserve it. So we'll just leave it at that. Anna, what's your number?
My number is 10 million. So that's...
Is that dollars or is that not dollars?
It's not dollars.
It's not dollars. Ooh, okay.
So that's the number of units sold of Michelle Obama's memoir thus far. So that's
books?
Books,
yes.
and also ebooks.
Okay.
Yes. I think audiobooks. Because so she's on track for it to be the best-selling memoir ever.
Wow.
Which I just think is kind of in a time of very, very sad stories. I just feel like it's kind of lovely. It's a lovely book.
I've seen a lot of people reading it, but I've also seen a lot of people gifting it. It's one of those It's one of those things I feel like there are lots of people out there who've received this like four times already.
Yes. Yeah, in my family, I think one person, my aunt got it, and I think it got passed around for a lot of people. I haven't gotten it yet.
Yeah, you haven't been re-gifted that book yet?
No. Have you read it?
I have, yeah.
It's good.
No, it's, I would say the first two thirds is really good about kind of her childhood, coming of age, when her and Barack are like dating. It's pretty fun. The part in the White House, I actually think is not quite as good, which isn't overly surprising because as you read it, you just really kind of understand how much she really does not like politics.
I remember when they did that massive book deal and everyone was shocked at how much Barack Obama's book deal was. And they were like, oh, yeah, I guess that it comes as a pair and he's throwing in Michelle's book as well. So that might explain it. It's like, no, actually, Michelle's book is the one which he's going to outsell Barack's. Yeah. OK, I think that's it. for us this week. Thank you very much for listening to All Things Apple and Purdue and Lyft. And stay tuned for Slate Plus on suits and whether and how we wear suits these days. Many thanks to Jessamine Molly for producing. Many thanks to Anna and Emily and you guys for all like participating in this incredible production that is Slate Money. We've been going for a while now. I feel like we're hitting our groove. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.